Welcome to Award Winners. I'm your co-host, John, joined by David, who has a wicked right cross. This is our night at the Oscars, where we watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer Wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In this episode, we talk about the sports drama Million Dollar Baby, winner of the 2004 Oscar for Best Picture. Dave, what's going on?
Not much. I'm excited to get into this film. How about you?
I've watched this one several times. I'm excited to talk about it as well.
Are we going to spar some verbal fisticuffs?
I'm going to duck and get you in the gut.
Right. Or what was it, the liver?
Kidney shot.
Oh, kidney shot. Oh, that's rough, man.
What's up with you? Have you seen any movies recently that are worth talking about?
I saw both Hobbs and Shaw and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I'm going to mention Hobbs and Shaw. It is a fantastic action movie, and it led me to think about whether we want to have Vin Diesel in the rest of the Fast and Furious franchise. It feels actually like he is holding it back in some ways with sort of his character's antiquated personality. He feels very much like he's from late 1990s, early 2000s.
You're telling me Triple X doesn't make it when it's 2020?
He doesn't. Don't get me wrong. I still dig Dom, but watching Hobbs and Shaw, you just get this feeling it could be so much better. And it's already pretty freaking good. But it's funny. There's so much action. It follows the idea of the rule of cool. So like everything could happen. If it's awesome, they can make it happen somehow.
Somehow they get to the next level every single time.
That's hope for space.
Cars in space. I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood also. That is a Tarantino film about Hollywood in the late 60s. The Manson family makes an appearance, actually a big appearance. I don't want to spoil anything, but I enjoyed that movie as well. I think that's worth checking out.
I think it's a great movie, and it's going to be up for an Oscar.
It's definitely some of Tarantino's best work.
When I walked out of the theater, there was a huge divide of people who either loved it or hated it. There was literally guys in the bathroom line were like, that's the worst movie I've ever seen. And I was like, really? Like, that's a lot to say. There's some really bad movies out there, guys.
Tarantino definitely has his own style, and it falls into that. And if you like his recent films, you'll probably like this one too.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
All right, Dave, we are here to talk about Million Dollar Baby. How would you describe this movie?
So I would say it's about a talented boxer who works her way into the heart of a gruff trainer.
Yeah, and I think that trainer gets her a shot of a lifetime, a title bout. I want to say to our listeners, before you go any further, we think it's important that you watch this movie before listening to this episode. We don't want to spoil this movie for you at all. Trust us, this movie is a winner, and you'll thank us for the suggestion. And with that being said, from here on out, there's going to be spoilers. Don't get mad at us if we ruin it for you.
I 100% agree with that. We usually do whatever we want, but watch the movie, guys, and then come back. Please, please, please don't just listen to it. I know a couple of our audience members who do that.
All right, so we're going to get to the red carpet and start spoiling things. If you're a first-time listener, you should know we eat movie-themed hot dogs while watching these movies. David, how is your dog dressed on the red carpet this evening?
I put some food coloring in some corn batter, some red food coloring. I essentially made a red corn dog. And here's the thing. If you hold a red corn dog upside down by the stick, it looks like a what? What's it look like, John?
An upside-down hot dog?
No, it looks like a punching bag. Looks.
I get it.
I should say that I thought about doing something with lemon in hot dogs, and I know we've done that in the past, but honestly, that was a really bad experience last time, so I skipped it, so I made the punchy bag hot dog. What did you do, John?
I did the million dollar dog. I got gold food spray and covered a hot dog with it, and I also did a corn dog too, just for kicks. I would say that's similar to injecting yourself with a bunch of chemicals to kill yourself, and I think that makes sense for this movie.
Was it tasty?
So the food spray definitely has this chemical smell, kind of like spray paint when it comes out, but I don't really think I noticed it too much. I think the taste of the hot dogs, maybe the sodium, whatever else is in the hot dog, covers up that chemical taste. Reading that list of chemicals on the spray, I definitely would not recommend eating that regularly, if ever.
So you would actually get the gold leaf that you roll it in?
Yeah, I didn't want to spend, I don't know, $30, $40 just to do that. But the food spray actually worked. So honestly, I was expecting it not to work on the hot dogs itself. I was expecting it to kind of run right off because it's meant for cupcakes and things like that. But it worked. That's also why I did a corn dog and it worked fine. kind of comes off a little bit if you rub the hot dog.
It's hard to mess up a corn dog.
Love me a corn dog.
Honestly, I do too.
That led me into our food fact discussion. I started thinking about what is the most expensive hot dog ever, just because this movie has $1 million in the title. Dave, how many hot dogs do you think you could buy with $1 million if you were just to guess?
I bet I could get at least 1 million hot dogs, like $1 a hot dog.
I think those are even nicer hot dogs. So I did some math on this. I decided if I were a millionaire, I would not buy the cheapest hot dogs. I decided to go for a pack of Nathan's hot dogs at Walmart, because obviously I'm a millionaire. I'm going to shop at Walmart. 16 Nathan's hot dogs are $9. Doing the math, that's about 1.7 million hot dogs, not including buns or condiments.
But do we really want the buns and condiments?
Are you just going to eat 1.7 million hot dogs without anything else, Dave?
Just going to dip them in water, just like, oh, I'm going to eat this this lukewarm hot dog.
I also know that Joey the Jaws Chestnut, so he's this year's winner of the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. If he could keep up his winning pace of eating 71 hot dogs with buns every 10 minutes, it would take him 4,173 hours or 173.8 days to get through all of those 1.7 million dogs. And a side note, his record is actually 74 hot dogs in 10 minutes. So he could go a little faster if he wanted to.
That's a lot of hot dogs. I would feel very bad for that man.
Yes.
I already kind of feel bad for that man. I don't know if you've ever seen him when he talks. I'm like, something wrong with you?
He just looks like everything is painful.
It does. Right? Yeah, he absolutely does.
I'm like, you're killing your body slowly, my man. I also looked at the most expensive hot dogs, and from what I could find, the most expensive hot dog in the world costs $2,300, and you can get it at 235th, which is in New York City.
I've been there. It has an amazing view, but it's sort of a shitty place. It's super expensive, but everyone just goes for the view because it has a great view of all the skyline. That's not a place I would hang out.
So next time, you and I can split one of these.
Yeah, great, great.
So they've covered their hot dogs in dry-aged Wagyu beef, black truffles, white truffle butter, saffron, Vidalia onions caramelized in Dom Perignon, caviar, gold leaf, and even more.
Here's the thing. What type of hot dog is that? Is it a cheap hot dog?
I don't know. It didn't actually specify it.
That's the
but
problem.
Maybe it's like a nice sausage made by hand by the chef. I have no idea. It did not say.
It's just a Nathan's hot dog.
It sounds really expensive and frivolous, but the proceeds from the sale of this hot dog actually get donated to the homeless. So I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
The most expensive hot dog proceeds not being donated to charity costs $169, and you can get that at Tokyo Dog in Seattle. It's a foot-long brat topped with smoked cheese, Wagyu beef, shaved black truffles, foie gras, maitake mushrooms, caviar, teriyaki grilled onions, Japanese mayo, all on a brioche bun.
Here's the thing. I don't really love truffles.
It always seems like they're like $10 for some truffle shavings, and I'm like, no.
Exactly.
It's just not worth it.
Yeah. It's like a way to shoot up the price, but it doesn't do anything.
I also think there should be a rule that three condiments is really the max you should put on any hot dog. Anything more than that, and it's not really good anymore.
Three condiments. I have to think about that, but in general, off the top of my head, that's probably a pretty good baseline. So like mustard, relish, and that's good. That's good.
At a certain point, you're no longer eating a hot dog. You're eating a salad.
I mean, AKA a Chicago dog?
Yeah. But a footlong brat topped with all of those things, like, what is that? Chili?
Caviar? Ugh. Yeah. I would not want caviar on a hot dog. Oof.
Anyway, Dave, you want to run us through some movie trivia?
Absolutely. So this film was released December 15th, 2004. The runtime is 132 minutes. The budget was $30 million, and this is going to blow everyone's mind, but the average budget for basically that year for all movies, or at least big movies, was $68 million. So this came in significantly under. Pretty typical of all of his movies, actually, Clint Eastwood's.
Lean and Mean. That's Clint Eastwood. Lean and Mean. Physically. and when he directs. Yeah.
So the box office, this is combined domestic and foreign, was $216.8 million. So quite a good return. And it was nominated for 7 awards. It won 4. And the 4 that they won were Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Actress. It went up against The Aviator, Finding Neverland, Ray, and Sideways. John, have you seen any of these movies?
I'm pretty sure I've seen all of these movies, but it's been some time. I remember thinking at the time, I thought Ray was going to win because I feel like Walk the Line was the year before and won a bunch because it's a bunch of actors learning how to sing and I felt like it had a good shot, but this one took it away.
Yeah.
And not that I think Ray's a better movie. That's just kind of what I thought Hollywood would choose.
Yeah. I've seen all those except Sideways. And I remember this year, I thought The Aviator was going to win.
So we should watch Sideways. You and I are taking a little trip, basically into wine country. That's what it's about. Some dudes going out into wine country together.
I'm up with it. I know that's one that's always been on my list to get to, but it's just like falls down the line. You know, you have a giant pile of movies to watch. And I'm like, do I want to watch a wine movie? Not today. I'm going to watch a movie about monsters.
I agree. I don't remember thinking Sideways was great, but now that it's been several years and I'm older, I think I might appreciate it more because I think the topic is kind of about aging to some degree and like not knowing what to do with yourself and having some kind of existential crisis or even midlife crisis kind of thing.
Great. I can't wait to watch that. So the highest grossing film for 2004 was, drumroll, Shrek 2.
Everybody's favorite Shrek.
Yeah, I don't even remember it.
I'm not sure I know the difference.
It made $436 million.
It seems like a low grossing year. Maybe our expectations are crazy now that movies gross like $1 billion every time they come out. Every Marvel movie is a $1 billion movie.
I mean, what, Disney has had $4 billion movies this year already?
Yeah.
It does seem kind of low.
And this wasn't that long ago.
I mean, 15 years ago.
I think the one other thing that I wanted to start adding to our movie trivia was the rating of the movie. PG-13. Looked yesterday at the case and I was like, PG-13? I thought this was an R, but it is not.
I mean, that makes sense to me. There's not any blood that I can remember and they don't really cuss.
I don't know. I guess I was a little surprised, I suppose. I feel like R-rated movies are the ones that usually win Best Picture, but I could be wrong about that.
I think it's a toss-up. If you're making a PG-13 movie, you want to get as many people as in there as possible.
That's the sweet spot, like PG-13.
Sort of the sweet spot. It's sort of annoying, though, because you can't touch on a lot of different topics. Like, I appreciate a good R movie.
For a movie like this, you could have gone with R. It's kind of a smaller, in my mind, almost art house film.
Yeah, yeah, I'd agree with that.
All right, actor facts and trivia. Dave, what do you got?
So, Hilary Swank, she has two Best Actress Oscars. One for this role, another one for Boys Don't Cry. Only 42 people have managed to win two or more Oscars for acting. Katharine Hepburn has the lead with 4, and she was nominated a total of 12 times, which is insane. And Meryl Streep has 3, but she has been nominated 21 times.
That's like a crazy number. One more minor note for this. Hilary Swank is the only woman to ever have been nominated for acting as a boxer.
Really?
I don't know how many women boxing movies there are, but she's the only person to have ever been nominated for a role like that.
That's really interesting because I almost don't believe it. But I'm gonna go with you because you looked it up. But like it sounds crazy because of
it was at the time, anyways. I mean, like it's been 15 years, but I couldn't name another woman boxing movie. So
yeah, maybe that's true. Hilary Swank has similarities to the character she plays in this movie. So she was born in Nebraska. She grew up relatively poor. Her mother actually brought her to L.A. to help her pursue acting, and they only had $75 in their pocket. They actually lived out of their car for a while. She is an accomplished athlete. She competed in the Junior Olympics as a swimmer. She also was in the Washington State Competition for Gymnastics, and she finished 5th. She dropped out of high school to pursue acting. Her debut role was in 1992's Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And she also starred in The Next Karate Kid. She was on Beverly Hills 90210 for 16 episodes before her character was cut. She married Chad Lowe, who is Rob Lowe's brother.
Have you seen Chad Lowe?
No, not at all.
He looks like a knockoff cheap version of Rob Lowe. Like Rob Lowe is definitely the more attractive of the two.
I got Diet Lowe.
Exactly. It's not even like a Diet Coke. It's like the Diet, right? The cheap Walmart brand of Coke.
For this film, she trained extensively, putting on 19 pounds of muscle, and she also did all of her own stunts. That's an insane amount of muscle. 19 pounds? Wow.
She started training some for like 9 or 10 months out. She's a total badass, honestly.
All right, so next up, we're going to talk about Clint Eastwood.
We have talked about him before in Unforgiven. Originally, Paul Haggis, who adapted this movie, was set to direct it and was given an $8 million budget. But Eastwood also really loved the story. He'd read it before and was brought in later as the director and also to secure more money for the film and raise its profile. This movie is actually really hard to make. No one wanted to touch it. It's a bit of a downer. It was kind of this like black sheep in Hollywood that was kicked around a lot before Clint Eastwood came on board and said, I'm doing this, whether I have to pay for it myself or if someone's going to fund me. Clint Eastwood won Best Director for his work on this film. He also wrote the score.
What?
Yes, he also wrote the score to this movie, which he plays piano, so very talented he is. Movies that Eastwood has produced, directed, or starred in have resulted in more than 40 Oscar nominations and 13 wins. He personally has 4 Oscars, 2 for Best Director and 2 for Best Picture. Again, that other film is Unforgiven. You can check that episode out. And he's been nominated 11 times. He legally has 8 children and I think a few more that he does not claim. He doesn't believe in monogamy, hence the 8 children. He was in a relationship with a woman whom he talked into having 2 abortions because kids wouldn't fit their lifestyle. And then at the same time, he was having an affair with another woman whom he fathered several children with. So he's kind of a jerk.
Yeah, but we knew that already.
Just remember this because I want to talk about this at the end of the movie too. I think this drives some of the things that he does in Hollywood.
Okay. So next up on our list of actors is Morgan Freeman. We talked about him in both Unforgiven and Driving Miss Daisy. He won Best Supporting Actor for his role in this film. He has 3 other nominations. His voice is really good for documentaries. He's essentially the voice of God. So if you hear him, there you go.
He does have like a really nice, buttery, smooth voice, but turns out, me too.
Me too. So it turns out that 8 women have accused Freeman of sexual harassment, and another 8 people have said they have witnessed this behavior. Because of this behavior, Visa, the credit card company, which he was a spokesperson for, suspended him in his voice roles for those commercials. And he has since apologized for his behavior.
So movie facts. This movie is based on a collection of short stories called Rope Burns by F.X. Toole, which I think is a very strange name. I can't believe that's a real name.
That's not a real name. There's no way that it's a real name. Are you kidding me?
So the stories have since been reprinted under the movie's title. There's one story in it specifically about this $1 million baby thing. It took several years to convince Hollywood to create this movie because, again, it's kind of a real downer. No film studio could be convinced that people would want to see a movie like this.
Sad movies don't sell tickets, except they did in this case.
I like this movie, so I feel like it did its job.
But I understand why studio executives are like, I don't know, we could put that same money towards something fun and like a bunch of people and their family will go see it. I get it.
Yeah, you walk out feeling like you've been punched in the gut emotionally.
Yes, absolutely.
And this is the third movie where Eastwood and Freeman have worked together. So they were also partnered in Unforgiven and Invictus. Although I think Eastwood directed Freeman in Invictus. He was not in it.
I have not seen Invictus.
I believe that's the South African rugby movie with Matt Damon.
It could be. Don't know.
I believe it
is. I'm going to do no research into it either. I'm just going to completely delete it from my brain.
Dave, are you ready to get into this movie?
Ready to go around? That's what you mean?
Step into the ring.
Ding, 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 ding.
All right. We start ringside. 2 regional boxers are going at it. In between rounds, we see Frankie Dunn, that's Clint Eastwood's character, coaching and cleaning up his fighter, Big Willie Little. That's played by Mike Coulter. He's best known for Luke Cage on Netflix. We also have Eddie Scrap Iron Dupree. That's Morgan Freeman. He's narrating the story, filling us in on his days as a fighter with Frankie. Frankie is the best cut man in the business. And they've been around a lot. You know, they're probably in their 60s or 70s at this point.
And so what is a cut man, John?
A cut man is the guy in between rounds who's cleaning you up, trying to stop the bleeding, making sure you're all right, icing you down, those kind of things.
I had to look that up. I actually did not know what a cut man was. I had an idea, but I wasn't sure.
He's very good at it. He knows all sorts of different tricks. In this opening sequence, we see he has a coagulant he's putting on his boxer, and he can't get it in deep enough into the cut. So he tells his boxer, let that other guy hit you, because it will work it itself into the cut. because they will stop the fight if there's too much bleeding.
All right.
After the match, we see Maggie Fitzgerald, that's Hilary Swank, asking Frankie to train her.
Mr. Dunn.
I owe you money.
No, sir.
I know your mama.
Don't rightly know, sir.
What is it you want?
I was on the undercard. I won my fight, too. Maggie Fitzgerald?
Well, Maggie Fitzgerald, what's up?
Did you happen to see it?
Nope.
I did pretty good. Thought you might be interested in training me.
I don't train girls.
Maybe you should. People see me fight, say I'm pretty tough.
Girly, tough ain't enough.
It's also kind of clear that Frankie, being late in life, is probably training what is likely to be his last competitor. And that, again, is Big Willie Little.
So as they leave the competition, Frankie tells Willie that he was offered a shot at the title, but Frankie turns it down because he thinks that Willie needs two or three more fights. Willie says, I have heard this several times now. It's clear that he very much wants a shot at the title. So John, how would you describe Frankie?
Frankie is gruff, probably tough. He's definitely been in the boxing scene for a long time and has seen a lot. He's good at his job. He definitely has a close relationship with Willie, but he doesn't have too many relationships in his life generally, but he does put a lot into the ones that he have. There's also this minor subplot. He's an avid reader and he's frequently seen reading Gaelic literature throughout the movie.
Particularly poetry on several occasions. It takes a special type of person to read poetry. That's not a diss. It just takes you have to really like it. You know, I feel like it's very literate.
Right. So he's reading like Yeats throughout the movie.
Yeah. So how would I describe him? He's a Clint Eastwood character. I feel like that's the best way to do this because Clint Eastwood plays basically the same character in almost every single movie, or at least for the last 15 years he has.
Yes. The gruff old man with the heart of gold.
Yeah. He's like, I don't want to do this, but you'd melt in my heart, and now I'm going to do this.
All right, I'll help you.
But just to be a little bit more clear, Frankie's a decent man. He's just gruff. He's old. He comes from a different generation. Yeah, he's a pretty good guy.
Maybe he's done something in his life that he also doesn't like, too. I think he regrets some things in life as well. I think that's one of the other things that motivates this character.
And so the other question I have for you is, why do you think Frankie keeps pushing off Big Willie's fight?
We hear this in the movie. So he says he wants to make sure Willie can win the fight. Frankie knows that he can go to the championship and fight for a title, but he wants to make sure that he can win when he's there as well. So he's been playing it really conservatively.
Really is probably an understatement. He's been playing it super conservatively.
Yes. Yeah. And Willie's been hearing this two or three more fights for a long time.
So question I have for you, John, what did you think when you saw that it was Mike Coulter?
Well, I had no idea who it was when I saw the movie then, but now I'm like, oh, it's Luke Cage. That's what I thought. I don't know. What did you think?
So I had never seen this movie before. I should get that out. So this was a completely new experience for me. I did not know anything going into it other than it was a boxing movie.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I saw this in the theater way back in 2004.
So I got none of that. So when I saw him, I was like, oh shit, Marvel in the house.
Yeah, there's a bunch of Marvel guys in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's reached that point and there's been so many Marvel movies that it's bound to happen, right? Like,
and that's actually what we meet in the next scene. So Frankie's gym, it's called the Hit Pit, which should be our porn name for this movie. We meet the cast of characters. There's the dumb one who doesn't know better, and that's played by Jay Baruchel. He's this Canadian actor who's been in a bunch of like Seth Rogen movies. Then there's like the dumb other one, and that's Michael Pena. So that's Luis from Ant-Man. And the locksmith from Paul Haggis, the writer's previous movie, Crash, which is how I kind of think he might have been cast to some degree.
I think you mean his next movie, Crash.
So Crash came out the year before.
Came out in 2003?
Yes. But these movies, I don't think it had been released by the time this movie's production had started.
Got
so
it.
So like, okay. Paul Haggis did not yet have his Oscar when this movie came out.
Got
or
it.
Maybe he would have been able to direct. I don't know.
That's good to know. That's really interesting. But you're probably exactly right. You win an Oscar, like, they're going to give you more money. Like, they're going to give you more than $8 million.
Right. So he hadn't yet won for Crash. And there's also the other guy who thinks he's better than everyone else at the gym. That's Anthony Mackie, who is the Falcon in the Marvel movies as well. So managing the Hit Pit is Eddie Scrap Iron, as we called him. That's Morgan Freeman again. He's kind of the caretaker, janitor, manager kind of thing of the location. He's keeping everything together with duct tape. So it seems to be like a minimal amount of budget, those kind of things. How would you describe Morgan Freeman's character of Eddie?
It's a Morgan Freeman playing Morgan Freeman character. I know that's like, it's going to be a running joke for me, I think. If I actually had to describe him, you know, he pays attention to everything. He's smarter than he appears. He is sort of soft-hearted and he's very broke.
Yeah, so he lives in the gym. I think he's kind of the opposite in terms of literature. He's reading comic books throughout the movie, where you've got Frankie reading high concept poetry. He was supposed to actually be reading Superman comics, but they couldn't secure the rights fast enough to have it in their production. So we see him reading a cross-gen comic called Mystic, which is actually about a woman who suddenly finds herself with unwanted magical abilities. I actually feel like that parallels Maggie's path a little bit. Like she suddenly like rises to stardom and has this power. Ever read that comic, Dave?
I have never read any of cross-gen. I actually looked it up to see if I had read any of those comics. I haven't. There was a whole different universe with cross-gen. The only character that I even recognized was Snake Plissken, who was not part of the cross-gen universe, but like a tie-in to something else.
So it was called the Sigilverse, and guess who bought it? Marvel, because cross-gen folded. I think the other thing to note about Eddie is that he's blind in one eye. It's sort of Frankie's fault. They were in a fight. Eddie wanted to continue the fight, but he had a very serious cut above his eye, and Frankie told him he probably shouldn't, but let the fight continue. As a result, you know, he's blind in that eye, and Frankie really blames himself for this. I think this is actually why he's playing conservatively with his champ, Willie.
I think later on, they mentioned that Scrap was a very good fighter. He could have been a title contender. In the next scene, Willie arrives at the gym, and he is greeted by another manager. And this manager is willing to offer him a shot at the title. Frankie ignores a warning from Eddie about what's happening, and basically tells him, go back to reading your book. But out of the corner of his eye, Frankie sees that Maggie is there working on a punching bag.
Wasting your time. I told you I don't train girls.
Thought you might change your mind.
There's dozens of trainers who train girls. You won't have any trouble finding one.
You'll hardly need a dozen, boss. You'll do fine.
Don't call me boss now. I'm not your boss, and don't you be calling me that.
If I stop calling you boss, will you train me?
No.
Then I might as well just keep calling you it.
She came from southwestern Missouri. The hills outside the scratch-ass Ozark town of Theodosia. Set in the cedars and oak trees somewhere between nowhere and goodbye. She grew up knowing one thing. She was trash.
So we learn Maggie's backstory. Her family is kind of abusive, I'd say more mentally and emotionally than physically. They have no money. She's really got no education, but she wants to make something more of herself and loves boxing. So I think this is like kind of a way to use that phrase, pull herself up by her bootstraps. You know, she's getting tougher mentally and physically in this whole process. And she feels like that's a way to rise above her station in life. She's been in a couple amateur boxing matches and won. Initially, Frankie asks Eddie to get rid of Maggie, but then finds out that she's paid for 6 months of gym dues. And Frankie really can't pass that money up because it seems like the gym isn't particularly successful.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you describe Maggie's character?
So I would say that she is determined, very strong, very headstrong, excitable. She's also looking for someone to be part of her family. She's looking for just someone to have in her life that is better than what she came from.
I mean, she has family, but not really.
As Dave Chappelle would say, they're poopy.
She's a waitress. We see her taking food off of people's plates they haven't finished and taking it home with her at night, because she doesn't have anything. So things are not particularly good for Maggie. And we also see in the gym, there are less talented men in this gym. Frankie allows those guys to box there, but he won't even allow her to do that. And she's got to pay 6 months worth of money to do this. One of the characters, he's mentally disabled, and he's allowed to box there, and he doesn't pay any dues at all. In terms of the totem pole, Maggie's at the very, very bottom, below a person who's not mentally fit to probably be boxing. One night we see that the gym is shut down. Eddie, he runs into Maggie and he sees her working the bag, feels for her. He understands like her passion and drive and how she doesn't have anything else going for her in life and how boxing just makes her feel good. She really likes doing it. He starts to give her pointers. So Dave, you know, what else do you think about that relationship that starts to form between Eddie and Maggie?
I think that Eddie is smarter than people think he is, and he's actually has a very good eye for boxers, and he notices that she's an exceptional talent, and he knows that with the right training, not from him, but from Frankie, that she could be even better. So it's almost like he is helping Frankie with getting another really good boxer, sort of reliving his own past by watching someone rise through the ranks, and then helping someone who is, for all intents and purposes, a very driven and good person.
I like that read, Dave. He's spotting the raw talent. He's feeding her information so that she can potentially win Frankie over. So he's sly, right? Like, he knows what's going on.
Instead of scrap, it should be sly.
Yeah. Sly iron.
Sly iron. Slippery.
So as Maggie progresses, she also has to deal with sexism from the other boxers. She handles it, right? So we see that she can handle herself in and outside of the ring. Frankie notices that Maggie has his speed bag too. He's like, how did that happen? He looks at Eddie and Eddie's like, beats me. But Eddie was the one that provided it to Maggie to practice with because she literally didn't know that's how she was supposed to be progressing.
Yeah. I guess we should say that she's in her early 30s. She has been training for 2 years, but she doesn't really have a trainer. Basically, she just watches fights and knows how to throw punches. And she doesn't really know what she's doing. She's getting by on raw talent.
I'm not even sure she knows how to throw a punch because when they're watching, they're like, you know, she's going to break her wrist doing that, punching the way she punches.
I'm going to need that speed bag back.
This bag?
Yes, that bag. That's my bag. And if you're hitting it, people will think I'm training you.
Is that such a bad thing, boss?
Yes, it is. Every time you touch it, you're losing me business out here.
I gotta agree, I am embarrassing myself.
Can't just lend it to anybody, you know.
I understand.
Look, you seem like a nice girl. Can I give you some advice?
I'd appreciate that.
You're going to find a trainer either in this gym or somewhere else that's going to want to train a girl. It's the latest freak show out there. But the only trouble is they're going to be wasting your time because you're too old.
I don't feel that old.
Well, neither do I, but you don't see me fighting 21-year-olds, do you? It takes about 4 years to train a fighter. How old are you?
31 until my next birthday.
Well, there you go, 31. You wouldn't start training to be a ballerina at 31 now, would you?
Ara been working it for 3 years.
And you can't hit a speed bag? What kind of training is that?
Never had any, boss.
Well, I hate to say it, but it shows. Somebody's got to be honest with you. I hate to be the one to tell you the truth.
Yeah. Well, sorry for using your bag, Mr. Dunn.
You're not going to cry now, are you?
No, sir.
Here. Keep the goddamn thing.
No, you need it.
No, take the bag.
You know what I think's crazy? Maybe it's not crazy, but maybe it's actually sort of enlightening. Like, someone who in their late 20s, are like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a boxer. Like, I feel like that's a very rare story because even in the film, he's like, you're too old. You should have started when you were 12 or 16. So that adds like another layer to this film of this underdog story.
You know, it's going to take 4 years or whatever to train her. So she'd be 35. There's no 35-year-old boxers. That's geriatric by boxing terms.
So a short time later, Willie leaves Frankie for a manager who actually gives him a shot at the title. And we see that while Willie appreciates Frankie and everything he's done for him, he just can't wait anymore. He has to have that shot.
I heard about Willie. It's cold. That's dead cold. Of course, it wouldn't be so bad if he went so damn old.
Yeah, well, at least I can see through both eyes.
Mm-hmm. Didn't do you a lot of good, though, did it?
Well, I've got the gym. Don't need to be training fighters at my age.
Mm-hmm. Willie tell you why?
It's Mickey. Mickey's got the connections.
Oh, it ain't about connections, Frankie. It's about you not believing in him.
Well, I found him. I stuck with him for 8 years. How's that for not believing in him?
You could have got him a title fight 2 years ago. Hell, he knew that. I'm amazed he stayed around this long.
Yeah, well, getting there and taking home the belt are two different things. What was I supposed to do? Just put him in over his head? Not protect him?
Oh, you were protecting him from the championship.
Yeah.
Well, now it makes sense.
But what about you, Scrap? What did your manager do? You were a hell of a fighter, a lot better than Willie. He get you a title fight, or did he just bust you out banging your head against other people's fists until you lost your eye?
I had my shot. I went out swinging, and no man can say I didn't.
Yeah, well, I remember. And excuse me if I didn't want my fighter spending the second half of his life cleaning up other people's spit.
Yeah, right. Right, you're the smart one. You're the one learning Greek.
It's Gaelic.
Well, you just protected yourself out of a championship fight. How do you say that in Gaelic?
We see Mike fighting. We also see that Frankie is watching on TV and that he is incredibly scared for his fighters. And this is something that carries throughout the film. He does really care about the people he trains. He wants them to do well. And he takes punishment that happens to them very seriously. It's almost like he feels that he is to blame for anything that happens to them.
I think he's disappointed that he didn't get to go to the championship with Frankie because he'd been working with him for something like 8 years. But he's scared to do it.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately we see though, like, Willie was right. Willie went with another manager and he won.
He won his title, yeah.
Well, I guess we should also mention, just to be fair to Willie's character, is that he was basically like, I need the money. It's like, I can win, but I also need the money. I have kids to support, so I can't do these tiny little bouts anymore.
I think he says even if he loses, he needs to just do as much as he can while he's able to do it, because a boxer's, the span of their job is just a few years, really, like before they can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
After the championship, Frankie actually heads into his gym because he knows Eddie's going to be there, and he brings Eddie a burger. And Eddie's like, you've never brought anyone a burger before in your life. Why are you doing this? It's really just an excuse for him because he wants to talk about the fight. And he knows that Eddie will have watched it.
Yeah.
It works out. And they talk about it a little bit too. And then as they're discussing this, they hear out in the gym someone going at a speed bag. And it's Maggie. Frankie is about to say, like, you should go home. The gym is closed.
It's her birthday.
Eddie stops him.
So it's your birthday, huh? How old does that make you?
I'm 32, Mr. Dunn. And I'm here celebrating the fact that I spent another year scraping dishes and waitressing, which is what I've been doing since 13. And according to you, I'll be 37 before I can even throw a decent punch. Which, after working this feedback for a month and getting nowhere, I now realize maybe God's simple truth. Other truth is, my brother's in prison. My sister cheats on welfare by pretending one of her babies is still alive. My daddy's dead, and my mama weighs 312 pounds. If I was thinking straight, I'd go back home, find a used trailer, buy a deep fryer and some Oreos. The problem is, this is the only thing I ever felt good doing. If I'm too old for this, then I got nothing. Is that enough truth to suit you?
Just hold it. Hold it. I'll show you a few things. And then we'll get you a trainer.
No, sorry.
You're in a position to negotiate?
Yes, sir. Because I know if you train me right, I'm going to be a champ. I've seen you looking at me.
Yeah, out of pity.
Don't you say that. Don't you say that if it ain't true. I want a trainer. I don't want charity, and I don't want favors. If you're not interested, then I got more celebrating to do.
Stop, stop, stop. Stop. The hell are you doing? Okay. If I'm going to take you on...
You won't never regret it.
Look, just listen to me. If I take you on...
I promise I'll work so hard.
God, this is a mistake already.
Mm-mm. I'm listening, boss.
If I take you on, you don't say anything. You don't question me. You don't ask why. You don't say anything except maybe, yes, Frankie. And I'm going to try to forget the fact that you're a girl.
That's all I ask.
And don't come crying to me if you get hurt. All righty.
We got a deal.
No, not quite. I'm going to teach you how to fight. Then we'll get you a manager and I'm off down the road.
Well, I hate to argue with you, but...
Don't argue with me. That's the only way we're doing it. I teach you all you need to know and then you go off and you make $1 million. I don't care. You get your teeth knocked out. I don't care. I don't want to hear about it either way. That's just the way it's going to be.
So Maggie's slowly winning Frankie over. Frankie sees her determination and that she maybe does have a little bit of raw talent. So at this point, Dave, what do you think of Maggie as a character?
I feel bad for her, but I also really like her because she is so determined. It's also sort of joyous to see someone know what they love and just go for it. She won me over very quickly. I wanted to see her succeed. How about you?
Yes, exactly. Like, she's a very endearing character. You know, you want to see her win because nothing is going right for her.
Yeah, she's a good, she's a really good underdog.
Yeah.
And I think that's partially why this film works so well.
This is like our Rocky Balboa moment, right? We see our montage. we hear the Rocky song, dun, Train dun, Harder.
Dun, dun, dun.
We see Maggie growing into a fighter. As Frankie and Maggie start to work with each other, we also learn that Frankie's estranged from his daughter. And he's been sending her letters every week, and they always come back to him unopened. He's also attending church every Sunday, but struggling with his faith. So Frankie introduces her to a manager, and she gets her first fight. Frankie decides to attend the first fight. He's sitting up in the stands. During the fight, we see Maggie slipping into some bad habits. She really isn't getting any advice from her manager. In fact, we hear that her manager wants her to lose because he's going to set up his other fighter to fight the person that she's going to lose to and advance her along in her career. So she's really just like a pawn in that manager's game. Frankie steps up into the corner between rounds, tosses the other manager out, takes over. She wins.
Yeah! Woo! So, John, at this point in the movie, the first time you saw it, what were you thinking? What were you expecting was going to happen in this film?
Kind of what I alluded to a second ago. That's the Rocky thing. You got your underdog who's going to train hard, maybe make it to your title fight, may or may not, you know, actually win the fight, but will have won the audience and respect for herself. So I think we're just starting to see her life turn around. You know, we're expecting a lovely, happy ending.
I thought the same exact thing. It was, I know where this film's going. I might enjoy it, but I know where this is going. This is a typical underdog, rag the riches story. This woman's going to find self-respect. She's going to learn how to box. She's going to be the champ. It's going to be fantastic. I'm going to leave this movie with an upper, feeling great. That's not where it goes.
Well, we'll get into it.
Yeah. So in the next scene, we see that Eddie is at the hit pit and he has a ton of holes in his socks. And Frankie's like, I'll give you money to buy additional socks. But Eddie declines and he says that he'd probably just use that money to go to the track. So, John, do you think this was a joke or do you think that Eddie actually has a gambling problem?
So listening to the interviews with Clint Eastwood, I don't think Eddie has a gambling problem. I think it was a joke because socks cost $2 and that's really not something you could take to the track. I feel like that is a joke in the extreme. Like, yeah, I'll take those $2 to the track and lose them.
I mean, it also maybe drives home the point that they just don't have the money. It's a shoestring budget that that place runs on.
But I also think, you know, Eddie maybe just doesn't care. Like, that's not a priority for him either. He's just like, whatever, I've got socks with holes in them.
I have socks with holes in them. I have a bunch of socks with holes in them.
I need to learn how to darn socks. I'm going to say that is something I need to learn how to do.
We could both do that on YouTube and then update everyone next time. How many socks have we darned in the last 3 weeks?
So I don't think I have any socks with holes in them right now because I tend to throw them away when that happens, but I should just learn how to fix them.
Okay. So as the movie continues, Maggie just keeps winning. She is knocking her opponents out, mostly in the first round. And eventually no one wants to fight here because she is too good at what she does. And because of this, they bump her up a weight class, which for fighters, that's scary. So John, what is your experience with bouts and fighting and even martial arts?
So I took martial arts for years through junior high school and high school a little bit and did fight up in belt level sometimes and sometimes in age level. It just like depends on who showed up to the tournament sometimes. So I remember one time as like a 15-year-old, I was going against a 35-year-old who was like 6'5", because we were like the same rank belt wise, but there wasn't like enough people. He just won. I was probably like 5'10 or whatever. I don't know. His legs could reach me from like any distance across like the entire ring. Like there's no way for me to win.
You have to take him to the mat. That's the only way you would do it.
That's like the interesting thing with martial arts. A lot of it's like non-contact. It's all about like point scoring and like being quick enough to get the advantage on your opponent. So that's like how that largely works. But yeah, he would have mopped the floor with me had it been a full contact fight.
So my experience with fighting, I wrestled from fourth grade through junior year of high school. I have some crazy experience about bumping up weight, having to lose weight. Oh, naturally, I would have been 180 something, but I had to wrestle 171 because the guy at 180 was a state qualifier. But one of my worst wrestling stories is that I went up against a guy who plays fourth in state who was heads and shoulders better than me in every single way. And basically, my entire goal was don't get pinned. I had made it through 6 minutes. I had two black eyes by the end of it, but I didn't get pinned. I lost the match, but it was a moral victory. I was so excited that this guy didn't beat me worse than he actually did.
I think we should have a whole movie for that.
Just don't get beat.
Let's adapt this into a screenplay and let's do it.
As a wrestler, I got beat up all the time. Bruises everywhere, black eyes all the time. Having to wrestle up is so scary because I was in the beginning of the heavyweights class. So like next person up could be 15 pounds heavier than you. And that could be mostly muscle. It was really scary. When they said she was going to fight up a weight, I was like, all right, well, this could end real poorly.
So what'd you learn?
What did I learn?
Always keep your guard up, Dave.
Always keep my guard up. Absolutely.
In her first fight at this next level, Maggie gets her nose broken. She goes back to her corner. She's cut right across the bridge of her nose. She says she can win. Frankie tells her, I think we got to call this. But she's like, you know, put my nose back in place. And Frankie says, there's really not a lot I can do. I can try my best to reset it and do some things. But that thing's about to break open and spray everywhere like a geyser in about 30 seconds. At which point the ref is going to call the match. But Maggie needs to win this match because if she doesn't, it could seriously set back her career. So she's like, all right, let's do this. She steps back in, the round starts, and she knocks out her opponent in 5 seconds. And also, she learns that valuable lesson, Dave.
Always protect yourself.
Always protect yourself. We then meet the Ivan Drago character of this movie, Billy the Blue Bear. She's a monster in the ring, and she's the dirtiest fighter. She's a former prostitute from East Berlin, which I love that description. She's the kind of lady who'll punch you when you're down. We hear that she put another fighter in the hospital. I think she hit her after the round, after she was down, something like that. Broke her eardrum and some other things. And Maggie says to Frankie, maybe I should send something to this other lady. And Frankie says, what, like your paycheck? She'll gladly take that.
Yeah, yeah. She's not ready yet.
So I looked up this actor who plays the Blue Bear, and her name is Lucia Riker. She's actually a real boxer in real life. She looks like it. So she was 17-0 with 14 knockouts. Her nickname was the Dutch Destroyer, or Lady Tyson. Wow. She then switched to kickboxing and went 36-0-1 with 25 knockouts.
Jesus Christ.
She is a badass. She looks like a badass too. But in real life, she is a Buddhist, believe it or not. In the commentary, she talked about how there were a lot of scenes in this movie that she related to, particularly the one where she bought a house for her mom. And her mom basically shit all over that gift and said she wasn't a real woman because she was a professional fighter and she should just find a nice man and get married. She was also a corner coach, kind of like Frankie's role there. And she saved a fighter's life one time because she recognized the fighter had a cerebral hemorrhage from the fight, stopped the round, had an ambulance come in and save the person's life.
Well, that's good.
And finally, she was training Ronda Rousey for a time.
Oh, Ronda, how quick she fell.
Well, she was like the total badass for a while, but that's like with everything, right?
Yeah.
I think you can only keep it up for so long. Isn't Ronda in like WWE now or something
like
that?
Yeah, she does wrestling and acting now.
Yeah.
Which is good for her. It's going to be a longer career.
All right. So Maggie gets offered a fight with Billy the Blue Bear, but Frankie turns it down, not wanting to fight such a dirty opponent. He also turns down several other high-ranking fights because they won't get Maggie closer to the title. So there are a lot of things like she can go to England and fight, but she can't take the English title really with her because she's not from England. So there's not a lot of reward for her to win. If she loses some of these lower ranking fights, there's a huge risk for her with no reward. Like she'll just be knocked out and out of contention forever. By and large, he's just waiting for a better offer from Billy the Blue Bear. You know, he wants to split the pot in a more even fashion than like 20-80 or whatever is being offered right now. After, you know, Maggie gets some of these offers, Eddie takes Maggie out to dinner to celebrate her big win.
Everybody's got a particular number of fights in him. Nobody tells you what that number is. Mine was 109. I just didn't want to admit it. Fourth round, this cut opens up. Blood starts pouring into my eye. Kept getting Frankie to patch me up. He's talking about throwing in the towel, but he ain't my manager. He can't throw in nothing. Round after round, he's arguing with me. I'm almost laughing because hell, it's getting more to him than to me. I go 15 rounds, lose by decision. Next morning, I lose the eye. In 23 years, he's never said a thing about it. Doesn't have to. I can see it in his face every time he looks at me. Somehow,
Frankie thinks he should have stopped that fight. Should have saved my eye. Spends his life wishing that he could take back that 109th fight. I wanted to go to 110. Thing is, if you want to get to the title, maybe he's not the one to take you there.
You tell Mr. Mack we'd be here tonight?
You go out and eat your cupcake. It's the rule. Always protect yourself. If she was going to leave Frankie, better she did it to him then.
Mr. Mickey Mack? I'm Maggie Fitzgerald. I hear you're a real good manager doing good things for Big Willie. But I thought you should know I ain't never leaving Mr. Dunn. So you don't need to make any more excuses to bump into me. Sorry for interrupting your dinner.
Maggie always did like taking him out in the first round.
So do you think Eddie set this up? Because Eddie is the one who took her out to dinner and then this manager happens to be there. I think Eddie is seeing something similar to the pattern that we saw with Big Willie. Maybe they're waiting too long. Maybe Maggie is ready to fight. You know, what's your thoughts on this?
He definitely set it up and he was giving her the option to fight if she wants to. He knows Frankie very well and knows that it could be years before she has the opportunity to fight. And let's be frank here. Maggie doesn't have all that much time. She is going towards the end of her, you know, athletic career.
Right.
Do you think he set it up?
You know, I'm not sure, but I like what you were saying there. Like, I like that read of, you know, maybe he did it to give her an option if she felt like she wanted to move forward. This is where things take a turn a little bit. So we see that Frankie and Maggie's relationship has gotten a lot more personal, very much father-daughter. Frankie is giving her advice on saving money and then says he has set up a high-ranking fight against the person who just lost to the Blue Bear. He definitely seems like he's avoiding the mistake he made with Big Willie. Maybe Eddie said something to him as well to be like, dude, get your act together. She's on a roll. She knocks everyone out in like seconds. She's ready for this.
I like to think that he learned his lesson watching Willie win that fight.
Yeah.
So in the next scene, Maggie and Frankie travel to Europe for a series of fights. Frankie gives Maggie a robe to wear. On the back of it is a Gaelic phrase, something from one of the books that Frankie is reading. It's, you know, lime green. I'm sure you understand what type of a boxing outfit it is.
It's Irish.
When she comes out, the Irish crowd goes nuts and cheers for Maggie, and she wins. She keeps winning, and basically it gets to the point where that's all that's left is the title match. And at this point, I guess we should say that the back of her jacket, it says Mekushla, but we don't know what that means. The audience has no concept, but people chant that when she walks to the ring.
Clearly the Irish know what it means.
Yes, but we're not the Irish. I don't know if you speak Gaelic.
Just on weekends and every February 29th. So back in the U.S., Maggie buys a home for her mother and sister, takes them there, and they're really ungrateful about the whole experience. They tell Maggie that she should settle down and find a man and that people laugh at her for being a fighter. And then they kind of guilt Maggie into giving them more money. So she's like constantly sending them money already. This whole scene, they're like cartoonish representations of white trash, like to the extreme.
Yeah, I completely agree with that.
What do you think of her family?
They're bad people in a lot of ways. They're shown to be scamming Social Security, being lazy, being ungrateful. One of them may or may not be sick. You don't really know. They give her a really hard time. She bought a house and then the mother is basically like, why did you buy this house? Why didn't you just give me the money? Now you're going to mess up my Social Security. And because you mess up my Social Security, you know, I won't have any money in the future. They're really bad. And your concept of caricature is spot on. There are only a couple times in this film that I think there are missteps. And this is one of them, because I think the acting is bad and the characterization is really bad.
I agree with what you're saying. I think her mother, maybe it's hinted at, she at one point says her mother's like 300 pounds. Maybe she's on medication to control diabetes or something like that. And I also think that Maggie associates being out of shape and sick with the level of poverty that she's experienced in life. So I think her being a boxer and getting into boxing shape is a metaphor for her working herself out of what she perceives as characteristics of poverty.
I think at this point, I should also mention that being on Social Security or unemployment, there's nothing wrong with that. And this movie a little bit implies that it's, you know, these people are lazy and they're not working. The way that I look at it is that you pay into something your entire life through your taxes. And that if you need a little bit of help to get from one job to the next, you should use that because it's there for you and you've already paid for it.
we really just don't know what the deal is. It just seems like maybe she can't hold a job. It's unclear.
It's very unclear. We just know that she's not grateful. She is a very selfish person.
As they leave her family, Maggie says to Frankie that she really has nobody else. He says that she has him and vice versa. I think this is like this tender moment between the two. They definitely care about each other at this point. It's not sexual in any way. I don't want it to even sound like that. It is not. It is a family thing. It's father, daughter. Then Maggie introduces Frankie to her favorite diner, which has the best lemon pie he's ever tasted. Frankie's so impressed that he wonders aloud if the place is for sale. So maybe when he is done with boxing, he can just kind of come here, hang out, eat pie, run the place. So Dave, you know, what are your favorite types of pie?
So I love a classic apple. I think I'm really down for a coconut. Mm-hmm. But as this is a show with hot dogs, I have to go with the hot dog pie, John.
Yeah, so this floated around last Christmas?
There's several different types of hot dog pies.
Oh, is there? Because I remember there was one, and I remember it being served cold, and I was like, what the hell? That is gross.
Yeah, so for our audience, there was a joke, I think, done by Bon Appetit, where they blended hot dogs up and then put them into a pie filler. The one that I am talking about, basically hot dogs and eggs.
It's a hot dog quiche.
Yeah, basically it's a hot dog quiche. I would not eat that other hot dog pie.
I would not eat that other hot dog pie either. That sounds gross. This, although it doesn't, I'm reading these ingredients. This doesn't look healthy. It probably tastes all right.
Yeah. Cheese, eggs, hot dogs. You can't really go too wrong.
Yeah.
What about you? What's your favorite pie?
I like a fruit pie of some kind. I'm not too picky. I like a key lime pie. That sounds good. A lemon pie sounds good. Like a meringue. All those sound good.
Yeah. I'm not going to turn down a pie. You give me a pie, I'm going to eat it.
Yeah. Okay. So the fight with the blue bear has been negotiated. It's worth $1 million, the fight, and the fighters are going to split it down the middle, 50-50. Frankie, before they head out, invites Eddie to be in the corner, but Eddie declines. Dave, why do you think Eddie declines?
I actually don't have a good reason for this. I didn't understand why he didn't want to go to another country and watch this fight. Maybe he knows that he needs to stay behind and keep the gym running?
That's one of the excuses. I think it's also that he is really nervous. It's going to give him too much anxiety to be ringside watching this fight, because if it goes badly or anything like that, he can just shut the TV off. But being there, it's too much for him to take.
Yeah, that's probably a good read too.
So the fight starts and it goes as expected. The blue bear is cheating. She's hitting Maggie after the bell, throwing illegal punches, and Maggie's rattled. In the next round, Maggie starts to throw some dirty punches as well. So Frankie's like, hit her in the sciatic. Just like keep digging into her back until she gives up. And the tides start to turn. Maggie is winning. So Dave, at this point, what do you think is going to happen in this movie?
So I was ready for the long fight, the montage. In the last round, Maggie's going to pull it together and win.
So at the end of the round, Maggie is pulling ahead. As the bell rings, Maggie turns to head to her corner, and the blue bear punches her in the back of the head. As Maggie falls, she lands with her neck on the side of the stool that has been put in her corner, and she doesn't get up. Dave, what's going through your mind at this point?
I lost my shit, because this is completely unexpected. This was not the movie I thought I was watching. I literally just like grabbed my head and looked at the TV. I was like, did this really happen? Oh my God. And in the back of my head, I was thinking, okay, no, this is fine. This is fine. She's going to fight through this, and she's going to get back in the ring. We have two underdog stories in one movie. This is great.
So we then find out that Maggie's paralyzed from the neck down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was not what I expected.
Yeah, not at all. And Frankie and Eddie are devastated. So like they helped her get there. They feel really responsible for this. She's stuck, right? She can't move. She's stuck in a hospital bed. And it sounds like she's going to be taken care of. The insurance and the boxing association are going to take care of medical expenses. But this is the end of her career and she's never going to do anything again. And Maggie's family visits her with a lawyer at one point, and they try to get money out of her. She tells them off and says never to visit again.
We should be like clear about what they did. They came to see her, went to like Disney World for a week, and then came in at like the last day and was like, sign over all your money to us. And this is her shitty mother, her shitty sister, and her shitty brother who never came to see her. It's a really bad situation. I was really disgusted because I was like, fuck these people so much. They're terrible people. But there right. Also in the back of my head, I was like, they're still kind of caricatures. So what were you thinking at this point?
You have a really visceral reaction to this. This is like the boxer reaching out and punching you in the gut emotionally in this scene, it only gets worse from here. It's not at all what you think, right? You're not trained to think that the hero of our movie suddenly it's gonna go to shit from here.
Yeah. And that's most likely why this movie was difficult to make.
I think so. At least Hollywood was not like ready to make a movie like this.
In the next scene, Frankie takes out his anger on Eddie, and he blames Eddie for making him take Maggie on as a boxer. So they both spend a lot of time with Maggie, but as they do, she's slowly wasting away and becoming less of who she was and what she was. And eventually she loses one of her legs because of being bedridden.
Yeah, I think both of her legs, actually.
As the movie progresses, Maggie eventually asks Frankie to help kill her. And he refuses. Remember that Frankie is a religious man. He's Catholic. Maggie then tries to do it herself by biting out her tongue. And she does this repeatedly. This was really disturbing when you think about it, especially for this character that you really love. And I was not prepared for how dark this film was going to be.
I mean, at this point, Maggie can't go anywhere, right? She's paralyzed from the neck down.
Mm-hmm.
She knows that she's kind of slowly dying. And she's like, why wait any longer, right? Like, the quality of my life is awful.
Yeah.
So, Dave, what would you do in a situation like this? If you were Frankie and you had a person who wasn't going anywhere, you know, things weren't going well in their life, would you help them?
Potentially. I mean, I think it depends if that person has really thought out the concept of what's going on here. Do they actually want this? If their life is really going to be horrible and miserable for 10 years and they don't want to be alive, like, who am I to tell them no? What about you?
You know, we'll get into this in our discussion at the end, but I think people should be able to choose if they want to die or not, especially in a situation like this.
Yeah, that's what makes this movie a hotbed and difficult to discuss in some ways, because I have a vague idea of what I would do, but I've never been in that situation. So I don't really know.
Well, I'm saying if someone asked you, you know, would you help them?
I mean, generally, I agree that someone should have the rights. Would I help them? I just don't know. I would like to think that I would, but I can't actually say yes.
Gotcha. Okay. I won't call you when the time comes.
Okay. That's good to know. Put that on someone else.
All right. So Frankie eventually agrees because he's visited Maggie several times. She keeps trying to kill herself by biting her tongue. So she's tried that several times and he's just like, you know what? I will help you. They're just basically keeping her sedated in the hospital at this point. So he comes in, they chat for a little bit, and in this scene, he tells her what the phrase on her robe meant. It translates into roughly meaning my pulse, as in my darling, or, you know, the family, the thing that keeps me alive. It's the thing that makes me feel alive. Controversially, with the Gaelic speakers, this phrase was spelled incorrectly on the robe. So the Gaelic speakers weren't happy about that. I guess they complained quite a lot, but they were also happy that someone was trying to encourage people to speak Gaelic. So
they tried, right? They're like, we're trying to help you out here.
So they did it wrong, but, you know, all right, whatever. Anyway, so Frankie comes in, he gives her a huge dose of adrenaline and it stops her heart. And then he walks out of the hospital and never returns to his gym, or at least not in the movie. So the movie ends with Eddie writing a letter to Frankie's daughter. He has been narrating this movie. It seems like the narration is actually a recap of this whole story to the daughter, explaining what happened, telling her what kind of man Frankie was, which is a good one who cared about people. And then that Frankie really hasn't been seen since then. And we just don't know what's happened to him. We never actually find out what happened between Frankie and his daughter, Dave. You know, what do you think it was?
So in my head canon, I think he was probably an absent father who spent all his time at the gym and training boxers and just wasn't there for her when she needed it. And there was probably one huge event, like he missed the wedding or something like that. What about you?
Maybe, you know, maybe he was like trying to get her to be a boxer and pushing her too hard or something like that as well, because, you know, his coaching methods aren't exactly polite.
Yeah. I think this also might relate to why he goes to church so much, because in the movie, he goes to church, was like every day or 5 days a week. It was a very large number. In my mind, thinking he caused Scrap to lose his eye wasn't enough to make someone go to church that often. Maybe he did something to the mother, or I'm just not sure.
They never say so.
And do we need to know? That's another question. Like, probably not.
I don't think so, because we can make up worse stories than what might actually have happened.
Yeah, that's true.
In the final scene, we see Maggie's favorite diner, and Frankie is pulled up to the counter. We don't really know what happens. Maybe he's purchased it. Maybe he's found happiness. That's where the movie ends.
So, John, I want to do a upper after this sad ending.
Okay.
If you had the opportunity to own a restaurant, any restaurant you ever wanted, what would it be?
Like an existing restaurant or just like...
You could start your own restaurant. You could sell whatever you want. Assume it's going to be famous. Like the restaurant that you would run or run.
I'm like, what do I want to eat every day? So that's a tough question. I like a diner. A diner's kind of nice. I'm coming up with kind of a blank here. I want to run a nice bakery or something like that, I guess. I want cookies every day that I like.
That sounds nice and wholesome.
What about you? What kind of restaurant would you run?
I would run a restaurant called Biscuit Barn, in which I made a variety of different biscuits, have seasonal biscuits. So that would be like different type of unique ones, but mainly focus on classic Southern biscuits and homemade jams.
That sounds good.
Call it the Biscuit Barn.
Dave, I've never had a biscuit from you though. So you better get started on this now.
I have made many, many biscuits. I have not made one that I'm happy with. Let's put it that way.
One day, there'll be the Award Winners Biscuit Cook-Off. we'll see what happens.
Put a hot dog on it. We win.
Getting into more of the discussion of the movie. So with this letter, do you think Frankie and his daughter ever actually make up? Or do you feel like maybe she'll ever read it?
No, I don't think they ever make up. I don't think she ever reads it. Someone who's spent years and years and years ignoring letters? No way. How about you?
I kind of agree. She's not going to open up another letter after years of letters. But I mean, she just returns them. And even if she wanted to open them, she doesn't have them anymore. So at a certain point when they stop, maybe she'll wonder what happened. But she'll never know because she never opened up any of them and always returned them.
Yeah. The only saving grace of this letter is that it's written and addressed by someone else.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Maybe she does open this one then.
Oh, but yeah, but if you open it up and you still hate the person, you're like, I'm done with this.
Blech. Or maybe you hate read it.
Hate read, yes. I'm going to hate read this letter.
Ah, fuck this. All right. Given what we know about Clint Eastwood and how he has several legal and unrecognized children, do you somehow think this parallels his relationship with his family? And maybe that's why he likes stories like this.
Yeah, I would assume so in some way. So also, we don't know if this was in the original, the short story this was based off of. But that could be why he was drawn to it, too. So I don't know, but I'm going to say yes, probably.
I think we see that in a lot of his movies. From what I understand, he does not talk about his personal life very much in interviews. But it seems that maybe he feels guilty about some of these things. Maybe this is something he's trying to do, is establish better relationships with his kids at this point in life.
Yeah, and he's mid to late 80s.
Yeah.
What do you think constitutes an Eastwood movie?
Interviews with him, he's saying, I want to do things that are different. If I get a script for a Western, I probably won't do it unless the story's really unique or it changes something. And we see that in Unforgiven, right? So the characters don't like killing people. The deaths in that movie are not fun. And it's really not like the classic Western of cowboys and Indians shoot 'em up that's like lighthearted. It's a gritty side of all of that. I think with this movie, the same thing. So we have this hero's arc and we think that everything's going to go great. And then it doesn't. It turns into a very different movie and subverts our expectations. I think that's why he likes this movie as well. So that's what I think of Clint Eastwood movies at this point. But a lot of the movies, especially if he's in them, it's like a gruff old man who meets a character who melts his heart and then he helps them in some capacity.
Yeah. And I would say generally he is a very, very competent director.
Yes.
His movies move very quickly. There's no superfluous stuff to them. They just go, 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 go. I really appreciate that from a directing standpoint. And to hear you talk about why he wants to do things that are different and unique makes me respect him more as an artist. He's done so many really unique things, honestly. Like the twin movies, like Letters to Iwo Jima or Letters to My Father and
Flags of Our Fathers, yeah. And Letters from Iwo Jima, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a surprising. He's like, I'm going to do a double. We're going to do the same thing, but from each side. Yeah, you're absolutely right. He does unique things.
But don't always know what's going on in his personal life. Kind of sounds like he could be a jerk, but I think as a filmmaker, I like his work.
Yes, yeah. And there's not going to be much more of it, I don't think.
I think he's going to continue to direct. I think he's kind of done with acting, he said, it seems.
We'll see. There's usually, what, one a year? He gets like one, maybe he had two last year, I think. But there's generally like one Eastwood a year.
What do you think the themes of this movie are, Dave?
So I think the major theme is perseverance. And this is someone who would do anything to chase his or her dream. Maggie, I mean, she's eating table scraps, and she gave all her money to the boxing ring instead of eating just so she could do this one thing that she loves.
And then never quitting. Everyone's telling her she's too old. She can't do it. She's a woman, whatever. She's like, this is what I like. I'm going to do it. I respect that. I think you don't always have to be good at it. If it brings you joy, do it. Unless you're going to hurt someone else, then maybe not.
Yeah. I feel like that's one of the, that's something that's not really discussed in storytelling. It's usually like this person has to come overcome all these odds to get a shot. It's never like, I'm going to keep doing this because I just kind of love it. Maybe I'll never be great at it, but I'm going to keep doing it because I enjoy it.
That would be the least exciting film ever. It's like us doing our podcast. We just do it for fun.
Yeah, but it's more real though, right? Like
it's like, all right, you're going to do your thing today. It's not going anywhere. You're okay at it.
I'm killing time. Killing time.
Yeah, I'm just killing time. We're having fun. It's cool. I think there's also this theme of rising above your status through hard work. Her family's kind of terrible, but she's going to try to rise above them. They're stuck in this rut. They're taking advantage of some systems. They're not doing anything different in their life. And when she goes out and does something and is successful at it, they even give her a hard time about that. But she's like, I don't want to live that way. I want to make something to myself. I want to make my life better.
This is something that I hear a lot. And someone's like, you can't choose your family. That's kind of true, but you can choose to cut toxic people out of your life. And sometimes those toxic people are your family.
It's true. What else we got, Dave?
Respect. I think that's a really big part of this film, like her self-respect. Because it starts with a quote about respect and that she didn't know anything about herself other than she was a hillbilly and thinking that she was white trash. That probably ties in some to the perseverance aspect of it.
I mean, she feels better about herself in those moments when she's boxing. And I think she comes to find her own respect through some of these things. Like, she respects herself.
Yeah, exactly.
At that point. And then I think the big one, which we'll talk about more in detail, is this right to die with dignity. Dave, you want to give us some historical context as to kind of what was happening in parallel with this movie in the news?
At the time this movie was released, the nation was going through this discussion about right to die. That was based off the case of Terri Schiavo. Terri Schiavo was this young woman, I believe she was mid-20s, who was in an accident. For all intents and purposes, she was brain dead. She was being kept alive through a feeding tube. Schiavo's husband wanted to turn off the tube because he said that she would never want to live this way. Schiavo's parents disagreed. The two groups went to court, and the husband finally won. That debate became a cultural flashpoint between the right and the left, with the religious right saying, no, all life is sacred, and the left saying people have the right to die and that this woman is functionally not herself anymore.
I think she was entirely brain dead with no prospect of recovery.
Yes, exactly. At the time, Rush Limbaugh, who is a scumbag of a human being, he was actively trying to tank this movie by spoiling it. As we just discussed, like, that turning point in the movie where she becomes disabled is a significant part of what makes this movie so good. So like, if you don't know that's coming, your mind's going to be blown. Roger Ebert actually wrote a column about saying how unethical this treatment of the film was.
Right. So he was saying, why harm this movie? Because this really has nothing to do with this debate necessarily. This is like one person's story.
After this film came out, people with disabilities were pretty angry because they're like, you can still have a fulfilling life with a disability. This film basically portrays it as like, all right, if you have a disability from the neck down, if you're a quadriplegic, that's it, you're done. I remember reading a quote from a director of a disability organization who was like, this is the worst movie I've ever seen. There's probably some exaggeration there, but I understand why they would be angry with that portrayal.
My feeling is this movie isn't about that necessarily. So it's the rise and fall of this individual. You know, she has everything and then it's all taken away from her. She can't live anymore because she's got nothing. She was on the top of the world.
Yeah.
She was about to win a title fight. She'd come so far and then everything is taken away from her. Her body's also slowly wasting away too. So Terri Schiavo's parents seem really selfish to me. They want her to be alive, but there's no quality of life for that person. She was in this vegetative state from 1990 until 2005. What is the right to life if you don't have one? If you take away the things that are artificially keeping her alive, she dies. Is she really alive at all? Because there's no brain function. There's nothing. It just seems really selfish from my perspective. Like, the parents just won't let her pass. Like, there's no point in keeping someone in some weird limbo state or agony or whatever. Especially if you're Christian, just let the person go into heaven, right? Wouldn't you expect that to be better than keeping them alive in this terrible limbo for 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think if you were someone who like pulled the plug, you would essentially be committing murder in some sense because you're the one who actually did it. It seems like a very gray area.
If they can't take care of themselves in any capacity and these things are artificially keeping them alive, is pulling the plug really killing them, or are they already dead?
Yeah.
Dave, you know, what's your take on this?
I think I agree with you, John. If you're essentially brain dead, you're not yourself. You're just not. You don't exist anymore. I would turn off the feeding tube.
I think so. Especially in that case. It just seems so terrible.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, being a quadriplegic, I still think you can have a fulfilling life as a quadriplegic. I would not be happy with it, obviously. But we can make things work.
I think it's up to the person, you know, if they want to deal with that in their life or not. You know, what's the quality of life in that state? And if it's really miserable, you know, and they don't want to deal with it anymore, I get it. I think that should be their decision. Why did this movie win?
I think this movie has great acting, a great story, a surprising twist. It was politically relevant. I don't even think it was a close call. This is just a very, very good movie all the way around. How about you?
I agree. I think we always expect the hero to win, right? This is such a shocking ending. It really subverts audience expectations. Again, we've been trained to think the hero's going to win or overcome adversity, especially when they've come so far, and then it doesn't happen. And that is why I think this movie is so good. It does all these things that we just don't expect. And then as a side note, I was thinking about this as we were going through some of the movies that we've covered. I think a lot of the best pick winners, it seems like new ideas are well received in Hollywood. And this is like an example of that, where we're seeing something different happen in the genre. You know, examples of other movies that have won that have blended or changed genres. Unforgiven, it changes the Western to not be like a fun thing. Tom Jones merges period pieces with this weird comedy. Terms of Endearment is another one where it's like comedy, but also drama mixed together into this family thing. And then even It Happened One Night, screwball comedy, something very different and new.
Yeah.
We could probably go on and on, but that's just an observation as we've done a whole bunch of these movies at this point.
And I think that makes sense because if you're into the movies, if you're into acting, you have seen everything a million times. So when you see something unique, you're probably going to reward it more. I know personally, I give movies that are trying something different way more leeway than I do like a traditional by the numbers movie.
So anything negative to say, Dave?
There was some mediocre to bad acting from some of the side characters, like a mentally disabled kid and the family. Like that was not great acting. I think I would have liked to have seen some type of positive depiction of people on welfare, but you know what? I don't think there was enough time to get that in. That was just a personal thing. Other than that, no, like this is an extremely solid, very good film that I understand why it won the Best Picture.
So winner or wiener?
Definitely a winner.
And I agree.
All right.
Dave. Porn parody name. What would you call this movie?
Wow. Would you do it for $1 million, baby? It's Switch Indecent Proposal. It's where, like, Helen Mirren comes to Chris Evans and is like, I'll give your wife $1 million to sleep with you.
So I call this $1 million Lady, and it's about a prostitute who has a shot at winning a title. And the title is Most Money Shots Taken.
I'm sure that exists. That actually exists. It has to be. I'm sure it does.
Well, that's an exciting movie. Feedback, Dave.
Our friends over at the Movie Cellar asked if we would do any B-movie bonus episodes. We might. Generally, our thought on this is that we're trying to get through this as fast as we can, and sometimes doing bonus episodes takes up time. But if one particularly hits our fancy, like, I'm sure there's one you and I could agree on, John.
Yeah, so like Avengers Endgame, that B-movie?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely that B-movie. Uh-huh.
Yeah. At some point, we'll run out of these movies to do. If we find something we really love and want to do, we'll do it. I have sitting on my shelf Reefer Madness, the musical.
The musical?
The musical.
It wasn't originally a musical, right?
No.
But it's a DVD of the musical.
Yes.
I don't know, John. That sounds like what we might need to do, because that sounds insane.
There's like a whole bunch of those terrible movies. There's the new Iron Sky sequel, which I would probably watch. It's about dinosaurs in the middle of the earth, the Hollow Earth theory. Yeah. I like the first Iron Sky.
This month, I have a DVD that I ordered coming in the mail. It's Velocipastor. It's about a pastor who turns into a Velociraptor and tracks down killers and criminals.
I'm in.
I'll send you the link. I talked to the guy on Twitter, and I was like, oh, man, I kind of want to interview this dude.
Yeah, that sounds great. Dave, what is up next?
So it's our pick, and up next is 1932's Grand Hotel. That's about a group of very different individuals staying in a luxurious hotel in Berlin, and they have to deal with their respective dramas.
Have you seen
it? No, I know absolutely nothing about it other than it was the next on our list at the top. So what I mean by that is that
we're just doing some of the older movies. I think it's like 1932. We're just knocking out some of the old ones. No one ever picks them in our polls. Yeah. We feel bad for those old guys. They're like shunned people stuck in nursing homes.
Oh. All right. That's what we have.
Yeah. So go visit your grandparents.
So if you liked us, you can follow us on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook. You could email us at david@awardreaders.com or john@awardreaders.com.
Thanks for stepping in the ring with us. We appreciate you guys listening. We will talk to you again soon.